The University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee plays a vital role in shaping the future of Milwaukee and Wisconsin. UWM's diversity, academic excellence, and major public research contribute to the region's economic development and quality of life. Meet the people behind the creativity and discoveries at UWM today. Here's the host of UWM Today, Tom Lujak, Vice Chancellor for University Relations and Communications.
Do you have a sore back or not able to do those moves on the dance floor like you used to? Well, as you head off for physical therapy, better listen to this. It is possible that a technique developed more than 100 years ago could help you move a lot easier and move a lot smarter. On this edition of UWM Today, we meet two UWM faculty members collaborating on a research project that combines neuroimaging and the Alexander technique, a system that dancers have used for more than 100 years. Joining us in the studio is Luc Vinet, Associate Professor of Dance, and Wendy Huddleston, Assistant Professor of Kinesiology. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Luc, let's begin with you. This old and new, this convergence of different techniques that might provide some interesting ways in which we could feel better as we look at our aches and pains.
Yes. Dancers have a close relationship with physical therapy. As a dancer, I was in the physical therapist's office every week, pretty much, on one side, taking care of my body, preparing for the week, preparing for any little details that would be left out, and on the other side, taking care of aches and pains that have arrived from the week before. I was always very proactive as a professional dancer to be on top of my body. You know, you've seen the stories, dancers retire early because of, you know, various issues. Here at the Milwaukee Ballet, they have a really close relationship with physical therapy. So at some point in my career, my back started to give me trouble, and it was pretty sudden. And I got involved again with physical therapy on a very intense level. And it was at the Cleveland Clinic. It was very specialized physical therapist who had body-mind centering as a side, special research, and also was a Pilates practitioner, and had worked with all the Cleveland Ballet dancers. And we'd been working for a while, and I felt it was pretty stable. My back was doing okay. We'd gotten to a place that was stable, but I didn't feel that I was sort of advancing towards healing. Now, I'm not blaming anything. It's really sort of what works for you in that case. And at some point, the physical therapist recommended that I stick around as this Alexander teacher would come and give a lecture to the internists. And I sort of stuck around, not knowing anything. And after the hour-long lecture, I felt that made a lot of sense and walked out of there and then went, what was that about? Like, how did that relate to movement? How did that work with physical therapy? I was a little confused. After I contacted the teacher and started working on sort of this awareness of how you do things, not so much doing something else, another exercise or another specialized way of getting into stretching or strengthening or something like that, but more finding a way to get into the awareness of how we do things.
And the Alexander technique, again, is really involving the consciousness in terms of movement as opposed to the physical movement of the arm itself. It's the thought or the motivation before you actually move, correct?
Yeah, very much so. And as a dancer, I'd gotten away from that. I'd gotten away from noticing the intent in activity. It can be very easy day in, day out I was a ballet dancer, so I would sit, you know, park myself at the bar, and somebody would say, well, do this exercise, and then I would just do this exercise, not realizing the undercurrent of thought that came I'm sure that anyone out there can understand that as they're checking their email, they're reading something, they're doing other things, there are thoughts that come up. And we often don't think that those thoughts have a big impact on us. But as a dancer, these thoughts, if they're not noticed, then can create sort of an undercurrent of activity. So then one exercise done with a certain thought and another the same exercise done with other thoughts might actually create a different activity for a dancer.
So I want to bring Wendy into the conversation now, because you're a kinesiologist. You study the way in which the body moves. Luke has just described connecting to this technique that was developed actually back in the 1890s, as I see in my reading and research. How do the two of you see your paths cross? Someone who's working in neuroimaging with a dancer who's discovered something from way back in the past influencing the way he feels or is able to move.
My training is in physical therapy, and my clinical practice was working for industry, and I became very interested in why some people developed overuse injuries and other people didn't. And I became progressively more interested in how vision guided these movements. And when you reach for your cup of coffee that's sitting on your table, how do you take that information that your eyes collect about the location of that cup of coffee and transfer that into information that your brain can understand to move your hand to that cup of coffee? And that got me to the point of attention and how we use attention to guide our movements. And that's where my neuroimaging from my PhD came in, where I started to look at how the brain makes that connection from what we see to what we do. So then several years ago, actually someone at the graduate school at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee approached me and said, I have this guy in dance who's very interested in attention and the attention to movement, and he would like to partner with a scientist to really look at how this works. And we met and immediately saw the connection of where I, as a physical therapist, was interested in attention and attention to movement, and here he was an instructor of dance and an expert in the Alexander approach, an instructor in the Alexander approach, also looking at attention and the cognitive component, if you will, of movement. And so we immediately saw this parallel in these two different disciplines and an opportunity to really interact. He working with elite performers and using this Alexander approach, whereas I was a physical therapist with training in cognitive neuroscience who could come in with a little bit different perspective and find a way that our two disciplines could talk with one another.
Well, and one of the key breakthroughs here is with neuroimaging, you're actually able to look at the brain and see how it is changing, right?
Exactly.
Whether or not an emotion or a feeling might in fact be registering in that scan that you're doing, and perhaps begin to predict or project what happens.
Right. So our hope is that we can take someone who has been trained in the Alexander approach and compare it to someone who hasn't been trained in the Alexander approach and see how their brain patterns of activity might be different. And then also to look across time. So take someone who's early in their Alexander approach training and then scan them over a period of time and see how their brain activity changes once they're able to inhibit unwanted movements or to be more aware of their movement using the Alexander approach.
Luke, as you think about the way in which you were trained to dance from being a young person who got interested and came along, looking back now, was there a flaw in that training in that perhaps you weren't asked to begin to visualize or think about the movements? Was this just, you know, sort of the luck of the draw? You began training and move forward without necessarily considering in your mind thinking about those movements in advance.
Mm. It's a really good question. I don't think there was a flaw. The often teaching in ballet in most forms is considered an art. It's fairly recently that even ballet has accepted science as something that could come and supplement the training. When my main teacher, Danielle Cellier, who died maybe 4 months ago. It's still very new for me. But when I was in his class, he demanded a clear attention. He demanded a clear direction of activity. He was not always... He would often say, "says, look, I expect you will know what the step is," meaning that you're now in an advanced class. What we are working on now is how, as a whole person, you bring yourself to the activity. He would often joke about people who would come to class sort of a little distracted or overly focused. And he often talked about a balance of attention within class. He was a master. He had danced with the Paris Opera, and he was a star with the Ballet Russe. So we're talking an extremely high level of performer, teaching a very old tradition. I think now sometimes we have veered towards more trying to teach the body as opposed to thinking of the whole artist. And I think that when that happens, then we can run into issues. I think that this split, even in the way that we look at performers, as opposed to looking at them as people who are doing tricks, as opposed to people are expressing through technique, something that is a direct, clear intent from the whole self. I think that's helpful to someone that's coming to the UWM dance department right now when we approach the artist as a whole, not just as somebody that's trying to do technique and not just somebody that's trying to express something without technique. It has to be sort of this overall plate. And that's the hard part to explain. And that's why us collaborating, Wendy and I, brings sort of a clear perspective on how we're bringing science into the art. And I find that very exciting.
Wendy, tell us a little bit about what happens when you begin to get this mindfulness into movement. In doing research again, I saw, for example, if you're putting your glasses on, you know, how you hold your head or position your arm may end up actually affecting the way that you feel once the glasses are on.
Absolutely. I think that we, as physical therapists, and I think even in dance, we focus so much on the faulty movement. So I might see someone with their head forward and I say, oh, you need to sit up straighter, or you need to pull your chin back. And that's the complete opposite approach of the Alexander technique. Whereas, again, you have to look at the whole body, where I might have just emphasized the posture of the neck itself. And so what is so exciting for me is that exactly what Luke was saying and how it relates to dance relates to the populations that are treated by physical therapists. Our muscles have a muscle memory, and if we move in a faulty pattern over and over and over again, that will start to be our normal, and we'll start to move in that pattern. And unless we're much more mindful of our movement, that perpetual pattern that's faulty will lead to injury. And it takes that mindfulness of the whole body to get rid of those faulty movement patterns, whether it be in someone with Parkinson's disease or someone who's dancing. So really the whole continuum of function.
Well, and to Luke's earlier point that you want to make certain that you don't become obsessive about one particular movement. I get that. I mean, you could become paralyzed, right? You know, I've got to move the hand in exactly the same way. Is it possible though that with this awareness, as you begin to really anticipate what you're going to be doing in terms of lifting your arm or lifting your leg, that could also create some problems of overthinking and saying, well, I've got to let this flow, and may it inhibit you from a sort of natural or easy style of reacting quickly?
That says, we know that as you learn a motor skill, the novice will do exactly as you're describing. If we take a golf swing, for example, the person who is going to swing that golf club will think about the position of their hips, the position of their feet, and go through the sequence of joints, thinking, okay, where is everything? Whereas we know an expert performer no longer thinks about those things. That golfer's thinking about wind speed, the direction they need to hit the ball, the direction they need the ball to go as far as a slight hook or a slight slice. And we see the same thing with movement in others as well. And so there's certainly a point where overthinking is too much. And that is what is interesting to me about the Alexander approach, is that you don't tell the person, keep your eye on the ball. You tell the person to be mindful of something that seems on the surface to be completely unrelated to keeping your head down during that golf swing, but really to be looking at the entire body.
Boy, anyone who is a golfer and has stood on the green with that putter in their hands, lining up that putt, here I am. I'll put myself in that category. Those yips can get you very, very quickly where you're thinking, okay, not too far. Wait, too far. No. And of course, it's disastrous if you don't have that natural, easy flow as you've described it.
And in that example, you're so tense, you've gotten yourself so worked up because you feel in that putt that you've taken yourself too far back and you know you're going to strike the ball too hard. And that's where the Alexander approach, at least from my perspective, is really taking all of that away. And instead of looking so much at a desired motion, really trying to inhibit those unwanted movements.
So, Luke, with this Alexander motion or technique, how do you allow for that naturalness while at the same time making certain that your movement is technically correct in terms of having the proper motion without obsessing about it?
No, that is such a difficult question to explain on the radio. Just to go back just a little bit, if we're talking about the novice that thinks a lot, and we're thinking about the expert that supposedly thinks much less and just let things happen, the main challenge would be to have an expert that is able to change its mind. And that is what we're aiming to do at all stages, meaning that to be, even though you're paying attention, that at that moment, the paying attention is not already locked into a perspective. So in dance, that means that there's a, and we talked about this a little bit earlier, the body sort of gets used to things. It gets used to the way that the head relates to the rest. It gets used to the way, the amount of anxiety we live with. And what we really need is a capacity from moment to moment to recalibrate the system, to be able to get enough feedback, like you're feeling your hips. And then at that moment, if you feel the anxiety rise, then you would know, oh, that's anxiety. And if I go with that at this moment, there's no way I'm going to be able to stop my habitual reaction. Because if we're talking, the expert has built sort of this habitual reaction that is well calibrated, then everything's fine. But if the expert's habitual reaction is slightly off calibration, then as you go to swing, then it's all reacting to a false premise. So how can we help you recalibrate yourself in moment to moment? For a dancer, this is extremely important. The daily work that they do is not, especially professional dancers, is not to learn a step. It's not learning to swing the ball. You've swung so many golf balls in your life. You've danced this step so many times. You don't need to learn it anymore. But what you need to know is if what you're thinking about your body and your mind is actually what's happening. That is the crux of the problem. So the technique is a method for allowing you to enter into this process, as opposed to already have given up the chance to open up that box. Now, what happens most times is at first when we start to open up the box and look inside, then we interfere. So that beautiful swing you had a minute ago, the minute you start to ask yourself, is it a beautiful swing? That's it. It's gone. So we're left with two choices. We either don't think and we can swing, or we think and we can't swing. But ideally, it'd be great to be able to think without messing up. Without messing up the swing itself. This is learned often not swinging a ball at a time that you're in a competition, or not while you're dancing on stage in front of an audience, but in smaller movements that don't seem to matter this much. So in the Alexander technique, we work with standing and sitting in a chair, or just somebody laying down on their backs and you gently move them a little bit. These motions have barely any importance. Anyone can sit and stand, and it's not like you're learning to sit and stand properly, but you are learning that in the moment where you add a little bit of pressure, like, oh, I notice that I'm doing this, and then you are thinking, well, I don't want to do this, and then you feel the pressure, and then you see your body going in a certain way, and then you can start to understand the chain of event and how to redirect the chain of event.
So it sounds like you really have to practice this. It's not just a one-off. If you're going to begin to move towards this mindfulness, don't expect results out of that first session. It sounds like it has to be very progressive.
A funny thing about that is that coming from a physical therapist, we're used to giving people home exercise programs where we say, okay, do these three exercises two times a day, you know, three sets of 15 or whatever the dosage is. As a part of this collaboration, I went through some private Alexander technique training, and I remember the very first day I said, okay, so what's my homework? What am I supposed to do? What am I supposed to do when I leave here? And Luke said, that's it. Just be mindful. And I wanted a prescription. And I think what you're saying is exactly correct, is that it does take time to get used to it. And there isn't a prescription. There isn't go do these exercises. It really is experiential.
You're listening to UWM Today here on WUWM. Good to have you with us this week. I'm Tom Lujack. Joining us in the studio, Luc Vigneault, Associate Professor of Dance, and Wendy Huddleston, Assistant Professor of Kinesiology at UWM, talking about this really, really interesting convergence of their activities and collaboration, as you have a kinesiologist and an artist, a dancer, thinking about ways in which we can perhaps teach ourselves to move better using a technique that's over 100 years old. We've been discussing the Alexander technique, and Wendy bringing to the table some of the newfangled approaches to studying movement, including the neuroimaging that goes on. Let's talk a little bit about the study that you two folks have been involved in. I understand you've been awarded a $50,000 grant through the Center for 21st Century Studies and it is really a challenge grant that has allowed the two of you to begin to try to document what is the result when you do marry the old and the new sciences into one.
That's absolutely correct. It's a 2-year grant, and so this first year has been spent mostly in developing a common language between the discipline of physical therapy and the discipline of the Alexander technique. And it sounds much easier than it has been, because we do use a very different vocabulary when we're watching the exact same movements, and how we would cue someone to move differently on the surface seems very different. But when we then debrief and talk to one another, it ends up that we're seeing similar things. The second year will be actually hosting a symposium of both physical therapists and Alexander technique instructors to come together to talk, and then also to do the functional neuroimaging that you were alluding to before.
And that's what's really new here, the fact that you're able to take those pictures of the brain. And is the goal to see whether you're able to retrain the brain, or do you know that that is going to happen and you're just trying to see how effective that retraining is?
Certainly, neuroimaging, looking at other rehabilitation approaches, have shown the plasticity of the brain, so there's no reason to expect that we won't see changes in the brain. So the real question is, how does the Alexander approach affect patterns of activity on the cortex?
Is there a resistance up until now, or reluctance on the part of experts in your field, Wendy, to adopt a technique that goes back to the 1890s?
Yes. I think that as physical therapists, and certainly this is a complete overgeneralization, so I apologize to anyone who's offended by the next comment. I think that PTs tend to be very pragmatic and very detail-oriented, and I think that what Luke said before was that we're combining this art and science. I think physical therapy as a profession is very science-oriented. And so some of the other approaches to health and wellness have really only started to be a part of the physical therapist toolbox more recently. And when this grant was announced, there were a lot of people in the College of Health Sciences, of which I'm a part, who were very excited about this project. So I think if there had been any resistance before, I think in recent years people are welcoming these alternate approaches.
Well, it sounds like a more holistic approach to addressing these issues. Let me ask Luke the question. Any resistance on the part of dancers, of professional choreographers, to see scientists like Wendy coming to the table and perhaps influencing the way in which you teach what you've described as an art?
Hmm. Well, I have to be careful about only describing what I do as art, in the sense that my own Alexander community would probably be the first to point out that Alexander himself thought he was following the scientific process and was endorsed in England in his day by 19 physicians who thought this should be taught to interns who were becoming doctors. And John Dewey, the American philosopher interested in education, felt that Alexander's perspective was sort of a physical manifestation of his philosophy. We're talking people who thought long and hard but did not have the tools to sort of represent their thinking of the time. So yes, there is an art to teaching the Alexander technique, in the sense that an Alexander teacher takes 3 years to learn this every day for 3 hours. It's a arduous process. It involves changing the way you perceive and attempt to interact with someone. So there's an art involved. In dance, there's often, in a similar way as in physical therapy, there's a perspective where people would think that, well, if I teach a step, and I'm in a dance class, I'm a teacher with, let's say, 15 to 40 students, and I teach a dance step, that everyone should be able to learn the dance step. It's rarely understood in terms of motor control, meaning habits and how habits interfere and perception, proprioception, and everything else. So yes, there is a slight resistance in looking at it from a more scientific perspective, where the whole being is involved in this learning of a physical act.
Well, it's fascinating discussion, and I think we'd like to have you back next year as this project moves to that next phase and you get some results, to see whether or not, in fact, you're able to make that match between this mindfulness and capturing that through neuroimaging, to see what the long-term effect is. You know, which is this a system that could be applied universally? So, thank you so much. Fascinating conversation.
Thank you for having us.
Luke Vignier and Wendy Huddleston, both professors at UW-Milwaukee, guest on this edition of UWM Today, as we talk about that bridge or the marriage of some very old techniques with new modern science, looking at how we move and ultimately how we feel about each other. Well, that's all for this week's edition of UWM Today. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next week at the same time, everybody. Take care. I'm Tom Lujack.
You've been listening to UWM Today, the weekly program where you meet the faculty, staff, and students at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee who help make a difference in the lives of people in southeastern Wisconsin through their teaching, research, and community service. To learn more about UWM, go online to uwm.edu.